Welcome to another episode of Inside UMiami Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Henry Ford, the Dean and Chief Academic Officer of the University of Miami, Leonard M. Miller School of Medicine. Today, we are delighted. I am just thrilled to welcome to the studio, Dr. Mario Stevenson. Dr. Stevenson is an internationally recognized molecular virologist who currently serves as the director of the HIV and Emerging Infectious Disease Institute at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. He is also the co-director of the Miami Center for AIDS Research and also holds the Raymond F. Shinazi and Family Endowed Chair in Medicine. Of course, he's a professor of medicine at the Miller School. Dr. Stevenson, Mario, what a pleasure to welcome you to this podcast. I know this is a topic of great interest to just about everybody in Miami and probably the rest of the country for that matter, because HIV/AIDS is still an ongoing problem for us. But before we get into this serious and interesting topic, I'd love for the audience to learn a little bit about your journey. I mean, how is it that this kid that growing up in Scotland ends up being the Shinazi professor here and truly one of the eminent virologists working on this very vexing problem?
Well, Dean Ford, thanks. First of all, thank you for having me. It's a delight to be here and be able to share my experiences with you and with the audience. My interest in infectious diseases goes back to my PhD years. When I was in Glasgow, my PhD mentor, he was a Greco-Roman wrestler. And
let me stop you right there. Why did you decide to pursue a PhD?
I was always fascinated by biology. If you ever see my children, you'll see the apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
Okay.
They're all fascinated by biology. And it seemed a natural progression for me when I had the choice of doing either biochemistry or geography or history. I just sort of aligned with biochemistry. And the amazing thing is you're always learning, because biology or understanding of biological processes changes so quickly. And so you have to retune yourself, keep up to speed with current events. I find that no 2 days being the same is what keeps me going.
Wonderful, wonderful. So you decided to get your PhD in
biochemistry. Yes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my PhD mentor, who was a Greco-Roman wrestler and a health fanatic, keep fit fanatic, insisted that we go running every lunchtime. And we have an old cemetery next to the university called the Necropolis that stretches back 500 years.
It's pretty famous.
Yes. So beautiful, you know, mausoleums where the whole family would be buried in one plot. And sometimes I'd be running through with the group. I'd stop to take a breather, let the others catch up. Ha ha. And I would read some of the inscriptions on the gravestones, and there you saw the impact of infectious diseases on humanity, where the mother and father and the 10 children are all interred in the same plot, and 5 of the 10, 6 of the 10 kids all died before the age of 5 years old because of diseases that medicine and vaccines have basically eliminated. Polio, smallpox, cholera, typhus, tuberculosis. And it just struck me as to what it was like to live with the realization that 1 out of every 2 of your children weren't going to make it. And I think that was the impetus. So I moved from biochemistry to actually studying tuberculosis. And the thing about tuberculosis is it's a bacterium that survives, hides out inside myeloid cells. And that's why it's difficult to eliminate with antibiotics, because the antibiotics don't get at those hiding places. But I found that TB was a tough organism to study. But that basically put me on the path to looking at myeloid cells, moved to the US to study viruses, because I thought they were sort of minimalist biological units. And then eventually I got to this intersection between viruses and myeloid cells.
But no less important than TB.
Absolutely. Yeah. Same sort of scourge, the same sort of impact on humanity.
So shift to virology. Okay. How did you start focusing on HIV? And where did you go when you came to the U.S.?
I went to Nebraska. I had three options. Go to Nebraska to study Epstein-Barr virus. Go to Yale to study CD8 T cells. And go to Nashville to study interleukin-2. So I didn't go to Nashville because I'm not a fan of country and Western music. I didn't go to Yale because the stipend for postdocs was abysmal. I went to Omaha because the stipend was twice what it was at Yale. I thought, easy choice. I'd never been to the US before, so Omaha was quite an experience. But I loved it there because the people were so nice, fixated on one team, the Cornhuskers, the college football team. And so life was simple. It was easy to spend 15 hours a day in the lab learning the new methods of molecular biology. And in about 1984, just after the causative agent of AIDS was released, we started working in the lab on HIV. And I noticed that when HIV replicated in the culture flask, that the cells were going through crisis. And I decided to study that process and identified a new pathway that HIV used to subjugate the host cell. My first independent paper was a cell paper.
Wow. And tell us about that mechanism. Mm-hmm.
So what happens is viruses want to preserve their home for themselves. They don't want their cousins and their relatives moving in. So when a virus like HIV infects a cell, it takes away the door handle. Every virus has a door handle, like SARS-CoV-2 has the ACE2 receptor that it uses to grab onto the cell and open the door. So what I found was that HIV, when it grabbed onto the door handle and entered the room, it took the door handle off. So other HIV variants couldn't get into the same cell. And it was a phenomenon that we coined superinfection or viral interference, viruses interfering with other viruses of the same nature. And we submitted the paper to Cell, and got glowing reviews, and the editor, a guy called Ben Lewin at the time, rejected the paper. And I was, young investigator. I didn't understand the review process. So I called the editor and said, "Dr. Lewin, I got three glowing reviews and you rejected my paper. I don't understand. I thought this was based on peer review." And of course, Ben Lewin, an English guy, very sort of pompous, says, "Dr. Stevenson, you're new to this game. Cell is the most prestigious journal and we take far more papers than we can possibly accept." And I said, "No, I think otherwise. I think you're rejecting my paper because it's from Omaha. And you don't think that people can do science in Omaha." He said, no, nothing could be further from the truth. Next day, he sends me an email saying, "Your paper's accepted." So squeaky door gets the oil. I tell the students who come into the lab, the only requirements you need for science, stubbornness and thick skin.
Result.
And persistence.
Result.
Right?
What a great story. Great story that's sure to hopefully inspire many members of the audience. You don't give up, no means not now, or you just challenge them. So,
mm-hmm.
A great example. So let's talk about the evolution of the problem with HIV. Now, this was a seminal discovery, and we learned a whole lot about that, and then the CD4 positive cells. So tell us a little bit about that pathogenesis and how we, and our current targets of therapy.
So when I started working on HIV in the lab, and a year later started my own independent lab, my mentor moved to Columbia. My chair says, "Mario, I think you'd be better here in Omaha. I'll support you." And so I basically stayed behind, started my own group. And we pursued this idea of HIV sort of turning off the door handle and asking, is this a way for maybe HIV to sort of hang in there to persist. So my first grant was to an organization called American Foundation for AIDS Research. It was started by Elizabeth Taylor and Matilda Krim. They were advocating for more attention on this problem that was affecting gay white men. Ronald Reagan was the president at the time, and who basically didn't use the word HIV. It wasn't part of their vocabulary. So Matilda Krim and Elizabeth Taylor wanted to raise awareness, start an organization, raise money, and direct that money to research. And so I was one of the first people to apply to this new funding source, and I got the grant to study how HIV perpetuates itself in T cells, how it maybe uses those as a sort of a safe house to avoid elimination by the immune system. And got some data and submitted it to NIH and got my first NIH grant on the basis of that. I'm now on the board of trustees of the American Foundation for AIDS Research. I've been with that organization for 30 years, started as one of their grantees, became a member of the advisory board, chair of the advisory board. That's now being done by Lishan Lovu, colleague at Cornell, and then joined the board of trustees to help with their mission. They raise about $50 million a year for AIDS research. And actually, one of the first initiatives that that organization took on was, why don't we start research, supporting research on curing HIV? So even before NIH became interested in the problem, the American Foundation for AIDS Research was funding studies to pursue a cure. And that basically put us on this path to understand how the virus exists in these cells. And what we and others found is that HIV has its finger on the pulse of the host cell.
And well, why is it that HIV targets this particular subset of cells?
Because they have the door handle. So the ability of a virus to infect a cell is dictated by whether the virus has the door handle, the cell has a door handle that the virus uses. So for ACE2, the SARS-CoV-2 receptor, it's that door handle is expressed in cell epithelial cells in the lung and others. And that's why it has a predilection for infecting the lung. HIV, it uses a protein called CD4, which is expressed predominantly on CD4 T cells, your memory cells, and on myeloid cells. And so we found that some of the earliest papers that revealed how HIV persists was work that we had done showing that when a memory cell is quiescent, memory cells live forever. It's what gives your immune system immunologic memory. You become exposed to measles, get measles infection as a child. But once you become infected, your memory cells retain that knowledge 30, 40 years later. If you become exposed to measles as an adult, they're ready to fight the infection. So you don't get a second measles infection.
Excellent.
But that's the bad news, because HIV infects those cells. So imagine the scenario, a virus that infects a cell that lives for decades. That's what gives the virus its ability to persist lifelong in an infected individual.
So in other words, now, before we get into those very important details, in the beginning, in the 80s, the diagnosis was a death sentence. And now we know that with the advent of antiretroviral therapy, many people are coexisting with this virus. So what has happened?
The pharmaceutical industry has saved their bacon. I mean, basically, with the information that was gleaned from bench research, understanding what the key enzymatic processes of HIV are, the synthesis of cDNA, the integration of the virus into the genome, the assembly of viral particles, all catalyzed by enzymes that the virus makes. Those were the targets that the pharmaceutical industry pursued and came up with really what is a remarkable armamentarium of small molecules that block those different enzymes.
So we just essentially blocking the mechanism by which the enzyme is able to do its damage.
Right.
But we are still not killing the virus itself that's making those enzymes.
And there's the rub, that we have antivirals that can keep the virus undetectable for decades. But that is not an end game.
Keeping it quiescent.
Keeping it hidden in its hidey holes. We can't see it in the blood. We have very sensitive measures to detect the presence of the virus. The virus is essentially not there. But if that individual stops taking the medications, within a couple of weeks, in almost every single case of an individual who stops taking the meds, the virus rebounds within a couple of weeks.
It wakes up from that state of... So let me challenge you here. Is it just the inhibitory effect against the enzymes that the virus is producing, or is it another way of suppressing the virus itself from actually making those enzymes?
It's a good question. And my own, and I think the general consensus is that it's the antivirals. It's not as if the antivirals are creating a state that allows the immune system now to do its job. Because when we take the antivirals away, if the individual undergoes what we call treatment interruption, the virus just rebounds as quickly as if the individual was first infected.
Okay. So tell us where we are right now.
We are one pill a day for HIV management, Truvada. And unfortunately, if we look at the numbers across the US, you know, a country with arguably the most advanced healthcare enterprise on the planet, if you look at the percentage of individuals who are infected, who are on the medications adherent, meaning that they're taking their medications one pill a day, and the virus is suppressed, that's only about 60% of the individuals who are infected. So that is a big number of individuals who are infected but aren't taking their medications, or they don't know they're infected. That's why lifelong antiretroviral therapy is not an end game. Keeping people on the meds is a challenge. All sorts of things get in the way of it. Mental health issues, poverty, access to healthcare. So that has been one of the main driving forces for pursuing a cure and avoid their reliance on antiretroviral therapy.
So imagine if I have the diagnosis, I have to be on lifelong therapy. Costs becomes an issue. Side effects become an issue. An interested patient, I would want to know, well, why can't we go after those latent cells that are bound to rebound if I stop my medication?
Yes.
What's stopping us?
Yeah. Nothing stopping us other than the virus. This virus has evolved ways to circumvent everything we throw at it. And it's the main thing it has on its side is its mutation rate. We've known that from the first days of antiretroviral therapy when we were using one inhibitor to block the virus, AZT. And within a couple of weeks, the virus was resistant to it. In fact, it already carried mutations because of its tremendous variability. It already carried mutations that allowed it to be resistant, even in individuals who'd never had the antiviral. And so that principle extends not just to antiretroviral therapy, but to vaccines. Someone said the virus is adept at catch me if you can. It continues to evolve, and we're just trying to catch up to where it is in its evolutionary journey. So that is a big obstacle, the obstacle to us curing HIV and vaccinating against HIV.
You made the allusion earlier that SARS-CoV-2, the one that causes, that's responsible for COVID-19, and the HIV virus utilize the same mechanism to get in. They look for the door handle.
Yeah.
But why have we been successful in one dimension and with COVID-19, but we still have to face this latent infection problem with HIV.
So we know the story of the variants with SARS-CoV-2 that pop up from time to time, and then we have to tweak the vaccines. Now it's Arcturus that's circulating, so it's probably going to be less susceptible to the vaccines that we currently have against the other variants. Now imagine that scenario accelerated 1,000-fold. HIV evolves 10,000-fold faster than SARS-CoV-2. In fact, there are more HIV variants in a single infected individual than there are flu variants across the entire planet in a single flu season. So imagine trying to find an intervention that works across those. But we're getting there. We're getting there. So that you've got that mutation rate. But the virus also, it covers itself in sugar moieties. The envelope part of it, the part that attaches to the door handle, the part that we want to neutralize to stop it attaching to the door handle, covers itself with sugar moieties so the antibodies can't get at the protein backbone of the virus. But now we have this exciting development in the field, what we call monoclonals or broadly neutralizing antibodies. And they have a weird structure. They've got this long tail that burrows into that carbohydrate shield around the virus to get at the protein backbone. And because of this discovery, it's there's a tremendous amount of work going on to harness the power of these new antibodies for a vaccine and for a cure.
So let's break it down. How these antibodies would solve the problem of latent infection?
Well, they technically shouldn't, because antibodies work by blocking the infectivity of a virus. So if the virus is hiding out in T cells and myeloid cells and just waiting for the opportunity to branch out, the antibodies shouldn't eliminate them. But here we have a study conducted at the University of Miami by Ron DesRosie and colleagues, where they used a gene therapy virus to achieve persistent delivery of these monoclonal antibodies in monkeys that were infected with SIV, the simian equivalent of HIV. Those animals had never been on antiretroviral therapy, but three of them got cured of their infection by this persistent delivery of this monoclonal antibody. Now, no one would have predicted that based on what we know about how antibodies work. But perhaps these antibodies have additional characteristics. Perhaps there's a phenomenon called antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity, ADCC, that can deliver a kill signal to the cell that it binds. Alternatively, maybe if we shut the virus down, the reservoir cells don't persist. Maybe they decay more rapidly than we previously suspected. I actually think it's the latter. I think once you suppress the virus and stop it from spreading, the reservoirs decay rapidly. And maybe that combined with the little kill signal the antibody is developing gets us to the cure.
That's a fascinating concept. So what are we going to do to refine that theory or test that hypothesis?
Well, it's being tested in a large number of laboratories. The challenge with antibody is when you inject antibody, you can synthesize them in a laboratory, in a GMP facility. You can inject them, and people have shown that they have antiviral effect, like antiviral therapy. That's very expensive. To make an antibody for a single shot, a 65-kilogram individual would need 2 grams of antibody.
That's a lot.
Hundreds of thousands of dollars to manufacture that to GMP. So what some people are doing, including the laboratory of Dr. DesRosie, is using gene therapy approaches, using vectors, viral vectors, as a sort of a hypodermic to deliver the genetic information of the antibody into muscle cells. And with the approach that he's using, the muscle cells basically turn into antibody factories. And the star performer in his experiment, what's affectionately called the Miami monkey, has been making 50 micrograms per mil of antibody for the last 7 years. No untoward effects. Still eating bananas, still throwing poo at the visitors. So that sounds great, but there's a big obstacle, and the obstacle is these monoclonal antibodies are, that I said have this long tail, are very unusual structurally. And the first thing that happens is the immune system says, that's a foreign protein, and makes an antibody against
the antibody.
So once that problem is solved, I think we have a clear shot at something that's scalable, tractable in developing nations for curing HIV.
This is a great place to pause right now, because I want to get into the cure concept of functional cure versus permanent cure and so forth. So let's pause here, and then we'll begin the second part of our conversation about HIV AIDS. And thank you so much. It's been informative. Now we understand the pathophysiology, the pathogenesis of this problem, how it affects the CD4 positive cells or target cells or myeloid cells and so forth, breaks the door handle and really establishes that infection. So then it goes undetected. But you have excited us now with this concept of an antibody that can potentially become a sort of a cure. And this is being developed, more importantly, right here.
Yes.
At the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine.
Indeed.
Fantastic. So, well, this has been an episode of UMiami Medicine, a podcast. And we are truly delighted to have with us one of the eminent virologists, an expert on HIV/AIDS, who is enlightening us. And please make sure you join us for part two of our conversation of Inside UMiami Medicine. I'm your host, Henry Ford, Dean and Chief Academic Officer of UMiami Medicine Podcast.